from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After a day of unrest that saw the country's parliament building set ablaze, Burkina Faso's embattled president, Blaise Compaoré, has been ousted, that according to an army official in a statement Friday. However, the president insists he is still the president and that he will lead the transitional government. We have this report from Press TV.
Burkina Faso's president, Blaise Compaoré, says he will not step down, this after the army seized power amid angry anti-government protests. Compaoré says he is open to talks with the army and the opposition and wants to head a transitional government, but the opposition insists that the president must go. Earlier protesters who were demanding the resignation of the president set fire to parliament and other government buildings. They blocked a vote in parliament that would have allowed the president to run for a fifth term. Compaoré has been in office for 27 years. The head of the armed forces has already announced the creation of a transitional body to run the country. Dale McKinley, political analyst and activist, joins us from Johannesburg to offer us some more insight on the situation in Burkina Faso. Mr. McKinley, is this effectively over for Compaoré, or does he have a chance to get back in office as he has expressed readiness for talks with the opposition?
Well, I think we have to go a long way back. As you know, Compaoré has been in power since 1987. And for those historians would know that he seized power when Thomas Sankara, who was a very popular radical left leader, was assassinated. And Blaise Compaoré was implicated in that assassination. So there's always been a great deal of opposition to him. And he's weathered many different storms over the last 27 years, including at least two coup attempts and massive demonstrations. But as you say, this time it seems as though it's the end of the road. And I think the trigger for that was his attempt to try to extend his mandate unconstitutionally, to change the constitution to give him a third term. And I think that's what triggered these mass protests. And the army, which Compaoré has been able to rely on, their loyalty, I think, saw the popular anger at this and realized that the writing was on the wall in this case. So, yes, I think my estimation and my opinion would be that his days are numbered now. The question, of course, is this transitional arrangement and who would be taking over and what role specifically the army would play in that process.
Thousands had taken to the streets of the West African country Thursday, protesting plans by the legislature to change the constitution to allow Compaoré to extend his 27-year rule, which began with a coup against the then-socialist government of the country. Opposition leader Zéphirin Diabré had urged supporters to, quote, keep up the pressure by occupying public spaces, closed quote. It appears that Ukrainians will get relief from the cold after all in the short run-up to the winter. Russia, Ukraine, and the European Commission signed an agreement Thursday on gas supply and transit conditions until March 2015, during talks in Brussels. According to the agreement, gas supplies will begin immediately after payment by Ukraine to Russia of $1.45 billion of its debt in the next few days, and a total of $3.1 billion by the year's end with the help of the EU and the IMF. RT's Peter Oliver reports from Berlin.
Well, it's been months and months of hard bargaining. At times, it seemed like breakthroughs had been made. Then, well, those doors were closed at the final moment. We were expecting to hear of a decision being made on Wednesday evening. We waited. And then we were told that we were going to have to wait a little longer, at least 24 hours longer. But the decision, the agreement has been signed. And it appears that it's an agreement that, well, it's a victory for everybody concerned. Russia gets the price it wants for its gas. Ukraine gets the help it needs to pay off its bills from the IMF in the EU. And the European Union, well, they ensure that gas will be able to transit from Russia through Ukraine into those European countries that need it the most. Europe relies on Russian gas very heavily, with some countries, in fact, getting all of their energy, all of their gas supplies from Russia. So it was important that this was shored up. And it's come really right at the 11th hour. It's the last day on Friday. It's the last day of term, if you will, for the current European leadership. And there were certainly some relieved speeches from the European Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, and the man who's been, well, really the point man on negotiations, the Vice President of the European Commission, Günther Oettinger. Now, Mr. Barroso said that what a way, basically, to end his term as President. Mr. Oettinger said that this wasn't just a victory for getting the gas back on in Ukraine and getting negotiations between, showing that negotiations between Russia in Ukraine can work, but also that this was a victory for countries like the Czech Republic, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, among others, that rely so heavily on that gas. They stepped down from their positions on Friday. They'll be replaced by new people, and they've put in place a legal framework that could see gas transit through Ukraine into Europe until 2019. So very important deals there, very important deal for the moment. But also, they mentioned that because Ukraine and Russia have been able to come to an agreement on this, perhaps there was a future for other agreements that we could see them come to.
In the east of Ukraine, a Russian emergencies ministry convoy delivered more humanitarian aid to the Donetsk region Friday. About 50 trucks brought 500 tons of food and construction materials. The convoy earlier in the day crossed the border with Ukraine at the Donetsk-Izvorino checkpoint, part of it headed for Donetsk and the remainder for Lugansk. The regions will get a total of 1,000 tons of humanitarian supplies from Russia. The meeting between parents of the 43 disappeared student teachers in the Mexican state of Guerrero and Mexico's president was, in a word, disappointing. Telesur's Clayton Kahn reports from Mexico City.
Parents of the disappeared 43 Ayotzinapa students say that they left their first gathering with Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto feeling the same as they did before the five-hour meeting.
We are not going to trust the words of the president, nor the commitments he made on national TV until the 43 normalistas are presented alive.
Meanwhile, Omar Garcia, Ayotzinapa student and survivor of the attack in Igualo, Guerrero, denounces recent reports that links the missing students to organized crime.
With what moral character do they come and tell us that we are connected to some organized crime group? There is no such a thing. It is an attempt to criminalize us and to reduce the problem.
Civil society continues to exponentially support the students, organizing protests, but also activities such as this Day of the Dead altar to raise awareness.
The offering is not to say that the normalistas are dead or anything like that. What we do believe is dead in this country is justice, homeland, and peace.
While the colors may be vibrant, and with a grinning festive atmosphere, the now common tagline, "We are missing 43," exposes the somber and gray reality in Mexico. Clayton Kahn, Telesur, Mexico City.
And it's been a busy week in the lands south of El Rio Grande, with a global call for an end to the U.S. quarantine of Cuba, elections in Brazil and Uruguay, and much more. To discuss all of this, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
It's Halloween, of course.
Right, yeah, the Day of the Dead down here on Sunday. So everybody goes to the cemeteries to put flowers on their relatives and loved ones' graves.
Oh, good.
Here in Nicaragua, the main thing that people have been focusing on has been the aftermath of the rains, in which a total of 32 people died here in Nicaragua. I don't know what the figures are for El Salvador or Costa Rica, which must also have been affected in a somewhat similar way in Honduras as well.
And Costa Rica Costa Rica is also looking at a volcano now too.
Right, yeah, that's right. Jeez. So the Central America continues and will always be vulnerable to these natural phenomena like tropical storms and earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, because that's its geography.
You're kind of like standing on a 2x4 between two oceans, like.
Right, exactly. So and here in Nicaragua, we've still got about 1,500 families in shelters in different places, which, and it's something over 7,000 people by the government's reckoning.
Wow.
And a total of 32 people died as a result of different incidents over the last three, four weeks. Because now the rains have stabilized, and the positive side of it all is that there's been a bumper harvest. Wow. In the second harvest of the year, so that's good.
That is good, yeah, that's good.
So yeah, and that's the big news here in Nicaragua, apart from the continuing progress on the interoceanic canal, which the institutions concerned and the companies concerned insist is on schedule. So I mean, the schedule is that they're supposed to start work at the end of the year. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, we're close to the end of the year, so that means very soon.
Yeah, 2 months.
So, other big news actually was closer to me than you. In New York this past week, they had the 23rd consecutive vote on the U.S. sanctions against Cuba, and all of the countries of the world but five voted to condemn the United States and call for the ending of the sanctions immediately. Only two voted against, the United States and Israel, and then the essentially U.S. military bases of Palau and Marshall Islands and Micronesia abstained.
Yeah, it's the same story every year now, isn't it? And that's been the case. I think the vote went exactly the same way last year.
Yes,
and I can't remember the year before, but it was very similar year before.
Yeah, one of them, Palau, I think, had voted against instead of abstaining or something. Something like that.
It's so weird, isn't it? The messages coming out of the State Department and the President's office in Washington are that, you know, everybody else is isolated but us.
Yeah, right. It's funny.
You know, isn't it weird?
Impunity is like love. It means never having to say you're sorry.
Right, okay. Yeah. So, no, and Israel and the United States are completely isolated at a global level.
Yep, that's right. It's obvious.
Yeah. On that particular issue, and another indication of the way that Cuba has made a mockery, made the whole U.S. policy of blockade against Cuba look stupid. They've just signed an agreement with the United Kingdom expanding their bilateral relations with Great Britain. The United States is the United States' most loyal ally.
Right.
Signing up to increase bilateral relations with Cuba. And there's been a lot of attention paid to recent editorials in the New York Times, apparently calling for an end to the blockade against Cuba. And does that get much echo from that? And is that the case? And if it is there much echo among other sectors of U.S. political and public leadership?
Official ones like that, yes. Some, not much. And one of the interesting points is that's become apparent if you're paying attention, if you're reading New York Times editorials and such, is that a significant, in fact, majority of the emigres from Cuba, the Batistaites that have been in Miami and the environs for the past 50 years, they now are in favor of lifting the sanctions.
Yeah, and that's a very logical development, and obviously just in generational terms, that you have a new generation coming to adulthood with a completely different view of their own identity, their history, and what their own relationship is with their country, their ultimate country of origin.
Right.
But that generational change is also happening in the context of an economic change in which the United States as an economy, and of course the United States economy is never going to be irrelevant in Latin America,
of course,
just because of the sheer size of the country as a market.
Right.
But in terms of its political prestige and status and control and influence, the United States is becoming more and more irrelevant.
Right.
And that means that, and that's a theme that we can cover in the rest of what we'll be talking about, but it's a deep theme, and that underlies also that change in the way people are thinking about United States relations with Cuba.
You know, it's to the extent that it remains relevant, in fact, this is the most difficult part of it, I think, for the United States, for people to understand, too. The United States' relevance to the region now is as an oppositional organizing center. In other words, that we all have in common that this guy is the enemy because he's trying to do bad stuff to us, and so we got to keep an eye on him.
Right. Yeah, and I think there's a very strong element of that sentiment, and you can see it in the developments in the region. And in Brazil, for example, and the big event of the last weekend, of course, was the really, really crucial election in geopolitical terms and in terms of Brazil's own society, of course,
right,
of the Brazilian elections.
Right.
Dilma Rousseff won by around 3%. I think it was just under 3% of the vote, which is very similar to the result in the last presidential election in Venezuela.
Right.
And that, and I think both those elections demonstrate that even with the very best efforts and with all the resources possible put into trying to win the election in the respective country, either Venezuela or Brazil, the United States-backed opposition, even with all the resources that they got from their backers in the United States, which don't only include, of course, the U.S. government, but also include significant sectors of the private sector, in Brazil's case, the network around George Soros.
Mm.
Even despite all those resources, they failed to, in electoral terms, to unseat the incumbent presidential president in Venezuela's case, Nicolas Maduro. In Brazil's case, Dilma Rousseff. And what you got there is a very, very strong, perhaps an impregnable vote of confidence in relatively progressive policies, because of the situation of each country is very, very different. In Brazil, in the legislature, the right wing opposition still have very strong what you might call focuses of opposition to the government. And there was an example of that in the days after the election, in which social participation measures proposed by the Dilma Rousseff government were actually defeated in Congress.
Right.
But I think that was very much a reaction against the result of the election.
Oh, for sure.
And you pointed out also in the comments that you were texting, that we were texting before we started talking, that there's a very strong reaction by the right wing against Dilma Rousseff's re-election, both in terms of procedural terms, procedural and institutional terms, because Aécio Neves, the losing candidate, is now calling into question the electoral results and asking the electoral authority to investigate certain aspects of the vote of last Sunday.
Right.
And as you pointed out in your text message, there's also the phenomenon of people inundating the Facebook page of the Brazilian army with requests for a military intervention.
Right. Yep.
That's very interesting, because that recalls what happened back in, was it 1964? Something like 50 years ago now, yeah. the coup against President Goulart in Brazil. And Goulart had been democratically elected. The army intervened, overthrew him, and instigated a military dictatorship.
Yeah.
That's a very unhappy precedent that these people who are, presumably it's a coordinated campaign.
For sure.
People who are sending these messages to the Brazilian army's website are invoking the ghost of that lamentable intervention in 1964 by the army. And so, it seems completely out of the question, but it's just a way that the opposition are pressuring Dilma Rousseff.
Yeah, you know, colleagues. They're setting the stage for something further, for sure, both with the attempt to challenge the validity of the election and the integrity of the election. I assume there will be protests from the right-wing groups that will be in the streets and disorder promoted by them, and then a call on the military to intervene. Maybe some sniper provocateurs. You know the script.
Yeah, it is a script, isn't it? Yes, it's very much a script, a scenario that we've seen in so many countries around the world and that is continuing in Venezuela. But to little avail, by all accounts, because the recent opinion poll on the support for Nicolas Maduro, President Maduro in Venezuela, a recent opinion poll by a centrist opinion poll firm, it gave Maduro something like 53% support.
Which is a little higher, in
the context of what everything that's been happening in Venezuela in terms of violent attempts at insurrection, the constant economic sabotage, the physical sabotage of the country's electrical generating system. And in that context, for Maduro to get 53% support in a national opinion poll is a huge vote of confidence in him.
Well, look at it, compare it to Obama's numbers or the U.S. Congress's numbers, where none of that's going on.
Right. And so, and you can see, and of course, the reason for that is because the reason Dilma got re-elected, the reason Nicolas Maduro has enormous support, the reason Evo Morales won, I think he actually won when the final tally was made known by the electoral authority in Bolivia, he won with 64% of the vote. And in Uruguay, which also went to presidential elections in the first round last Sunday, same day as Brazil, Tabaré Vázquez, the leader of the progressive Frente Amplio down there, he won with just 2 or 3% shy of the 50% that he needed to win on the first round.
49.4. So that, it was 49.4.
All right. Okay. Did it get that close?
Yes, it did.
And I was remembering an earlier result from the electoral tribunal's tally. But anyway, he just missed out. So there seems to be absolutely no doubt at all that Tabaré Vázquez will win on the second round, and the Frente Amplio will continue in government as they have done for the last 12 years, something like that.
Yeah, a few times.
So what is that all about? It's about the commitment by these progressive governments to a strong social component, improving health systems, improving the education system, making the economy more democratic in favor of the previously excluded majority, in particular in countries like Bolivia and Ecuador, for example, implementing policies that benefit the country's large indigenous populations. And you can see that reflected even in relatively centrist or even centre-right. I'd characterise Michelle Bachelet as kind of centre-centre-right, in fact. I might be wrong in Chilean political terms, but that's what it looks like from here in Nicaragua.
Yeah, in absolute
and she's
terms.
Been on a she's been on a visit to Europe, and I thought she was going to visit France, but in fact it turns out she only visited Angela Merkel in Germany and the authorities in Spain. She had a meeting with the new Spanish king, I think it's Felipe the VI now, and with right-wing President Rajoy, and that was that must have been a relief for Rajoy because it gave him a chance to get a break from the corruption scandals that are swirling around him and his government and his political party.
That's right.
But when Michelle Bachelet addressed the Spanish parliament, and she stressed the importance of efforts in both Chile and I'm sure her remarks weren't very welcome from Rajoy and his colleagues, but also she stressed the difficult economic situation in Spain for the majority of the population, and she was stressing the importance of implementing social policies that meet the needs and concerns of that excluded economic majority.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's so you've got even people like Michelle Bachelet laying stress on that component of their government's policies and of the policies that they see as important, not just for the region here in Latin America or in the Southern Cone in the case of Michelle Bachelet, but for the whole world, including Europe. Mm. So that's a very important message that's coming out of Latin America, not just from progressive countries like Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, kind of centrist social democrat countries like Brazil, but also traditionally countries that have been perceived as naturally to the right, like Chile. So and then you can see all this happening in so many different ways, can't you, Don? For example, Today the Mercosur countries, that's Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay, and three of which can be characterized without any doubt as being led by relatively progressive governments. They're meeting with the countries of the Pacific Alliance. I think it's a meeting of foreign ministers. And then they're having a meeting in Colombia, in Cartagena, in Colombia, and it's the Pacific Alliance countries are Colombia, Mexico, Chile, and Peru. And they're meeting their Mercosur counterparts to discuss the development of economic relations between those two groups. And so what is that? That's another manifestation of the ongoing tug of war between the two contradictory visions of economic development throughout the Americas. And in Latin America, it's the progressive vision that seems to be winning.
What's interesting is when you have essentially a center-right, when you have, I don't know, she's somewhere between Christian Democrat and social Democrat, European style, lecturing the Spanish parliament at the same time that Venezuela recalled its diplomat over the interference by Rajoy in the Leopoldo López case.
Yeah,
she's clearly standing with the regional integration project.
Oh yeah, in a very polite way. But there's no doubt at all that what she was stressing to Angela Merkel in Germany and to this guy Rajoy, I can't remember his first name, the current right-wing president of Spain, was that the interesting was this social dimension, and also that Latin America is now sovereign and then doesn't need to kind of take off its hat in the presence of the Europeans, you know?
Right, that's right.
And so Angela Merkel's visit in Chile, in terms of Chile's national economy, was mainly important because it's consolidating Chile's economic relations with both Germany and Spain. But in regional terms, it's a sign that Latin America, that even the European powers, very powerful political leaders like Angela Merkel, have to deal with relatively small economies like Chile as equals.
Yep.
Because regionally, Latin America is, I hate to use the word emerging, but it has in fact become one of the decisive influential powers in global terms because of what's happening in terms of its social and economic development. And it's developed a model. Even the Pacific Alliance countries are proud, and you can just see this in body language and the tone of comments. Even somebody like Santos or Ollanta Humala, the president of Peru, and Santos, the president of Colombia, you can see that they identify with the fact that Latin America now has to be taken into account by countries and powers that would previously have looked down on them. And that's a very, very strong psychological and emotional factor.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.